Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is music director, conductor, and composer Brian Damaris. Damaris is a graduate in music from the New England Conservatory and Ithaca College. He is an assistant professor of performance studies and director of opera and musical theater at Ithaca College. He also serves as musical director at Mill City Summer Opera in Minneapolis and is on the faculty of the Aspen Music Festival. He has performed with the New York City Opera, Florida Grand Opera, Glimmer Glass, and Syracuse Opera, among many others. Damaris teaches master classes and is also a composer. His art songs have been performed throughout the United States. And welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I want to talk about the beginning. Where did your interest in music come from? Did you come from a musical family?
I came from a family of music appreciators. And oddly, my brother is also a musician, and he's in the pop industry in Austin, Texas. But it really started from my dad buying a piano and my mom taking piano lessons, and I got more use out of the piano than she did. So she gave the piano lessons to me, and then just parents that really supported me all the way up through high school and college. It was interesting. I went to Ithaca College for my undergraduate. I was thinking back on that time, and I think when I went to college for music, it was still a hobby. Oh. I wasn't totally sure that's what I wanted to do. I had done a lot of music theater, but Ithaca College is where I discovered opera. And that's just where the opportunities came. Even as a pianist, that's my primary instrument, I always wanted to work with other people. So the slaving away alone in the practice room was only satisfying to an extent.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I thought, ultimately, it's about being with other people.
But you were taken by the piano early on and music. And were you interested in classical music at first, or did you have dreams of being a pop star at any point?
You know, my interest in classical music was the disco version of Beethoven 5.
Really?
Yeah. And, my parents will still tell you about the guilty look on my face when they would come into the living room and seeing me conducting it, air conducting it. Probably at 7 or 8 years old. And I remember my neighbor, oh gosh, we were 9 or 10, my neighbor saying, oh yeah, I love Beethoven 5, and he put in a tape of the actual Beethoven 5, and I was in denial about it. But I guess that sort of explains sort of why I sort of work on in both sides, multiple genres of music, theater, opera.
Yeah, it's interesting that you do both. When did you actually segue into knowing that you wanted to be a musical director and a conductor? How did that happen? At Ithaca College?
I played and even conducted a lot of musicals in high school musicals, community theater, and a couple professional productions in where I grew up, Lancaster County, at the Fulton Opera House. And it was, gosh, I just loved musicals. I was one of those people that listened to them day in and day out and had most of the words memorized to all those shows in the 90s when I was in high school. But at Ithaca College, when I discovered opera and languages, that's when my tastes really kind of deepened into the opera world.
Tell us what a musical director does. What is your definition? And tell us what some of your duties are.
A musical director is, in music theater and in opera, it tends to be a vocal coach who has the skills to bring the musical score to life with the singers, the orchestra, pairing with the directors and choreographers. And more, you're just being part of that vision for the show, or the opera, whatever the case is. In opera, you're also responsible for the stylings of the music, music theater as well, but the languages in particular, and the use of the language. It tends to be, you know, based on the traditions in both fields, you wear different hats in opera than you do in musical theater, though the days of everybody bowing to the maestro in opera are pretty much over as well, at least for me. I don't think they're ever a possibility, but you're part of the collaborative process and helping, particularly working with students too, helping blend the storytelling of the music and the storytelling of the libretto and the dialogue on stage, so it all comes together.
Do you feel like somebody who is a director does have to have leadership skills, though? Did somebody notice that in you, or did you decide that you had that particular set of skills?
I always felt I had leadership skills. I was a drum major in high school, too. You know, I was always sort of in positions of being a leader among my peers. So as far back as I can remember, actually, the leadership skills are important, but not suppressing the collaborative skills.
Yeah. You don't have to be a dictator, in other words, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time you ever conducted professionally and what it felt like, and what was it like for you to step up there and in front of an audience for the first time as a professional?
Professionally, it was very scary. I did my apprenticeship outside of grad school at Florida Grand Opera in Miami, And I played rehearsals, and I coached young artists, other apprentices, and worked with the guest artists that came through and learned from them. But what I did down there was call super titles for the operas.
Ah.
So six operas, just sitting in the back, performance after performance, kind of learning these scores and watching how the conductor went in and out of every change and every page turn from the back lighting booth of the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. And one of the operas I called the titles for was Madame Butterfly.
Ah.
And shortly after that performance had closed, I got an offer to be a resident conductor at a little outdoor opera company, outdoors at the time, Ashlawn Opera in Virginia, in Charlottesville. And it was to conduct, I had like 12 performances of Annie Get Your Gun and 10 performances of Madame Butterfly. And I said, well, of course, yes. You know, you're not going to say no to that.
Yeah.
And then you kind of figure out how you're going to do it. But the catch was that I was going to be taking over the show after a principal conductor opened it. And I'd never conducted a professional orchestra before. My only experience was occasional 20 minutes if you were lucky enough to get the shot to do it, or student productions.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, so I had to walk on and conduct Madame Butterfly with no rehearsal in a production that had been going on for a few weeks.
Wow. Yeah. So did you pretend like you knew what you were doing?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Did you let them know that this was your first time?
Yes. I think conductors, this is, we get very good at looking like we know what we're doing very early on. But, you have so much to learn from that. There's only so much you can learn in a studio or in a conducting class or reading or watching. Ultimately, it's about getting up there and doing it. And I feel in every part of my career, whether it was coaching or conducting or teaching, I've always just, it's sort of been like being thrown to the dogs.
Yeah,
you
just get up
go
there
do
and
it.
Do it.
Yeah.
Just get up there and do it. Well, you have to. I mean, you do have to reach the point where this is it, you know, either do or die. As a director of musical theater, you have to know not just about music, but you do have to have kind of a sense or finesse about drama, too, don't you?
Absolutely. I think that's been the biggest benefit for me of getting to teach at Ithaca College, that I grew up in the music school, in the conservatory environment, all the way from 4 years old of piano lessons and practicing. You know, I was one of those people that always did the music ensembles, that always extracurricularly was involved in performing. And I missed a lot of theater and drama training along the way. And being an instrumentalist,
uh-huh.
I was never in acting classes or dance classes, except maybe to play. And teaching at Ithaca College has given me the opportunity to watch acting teachers teach and theatrical theorists work and really give myself a look at music theater and libretti and plays and from a different perspective,
like
including
a whole,
opera.
Whole production perspective that you wouldn't have. So you've never acted in a musical theater production. You've never done any acting, huh?
No, I've made, silly cameo appearances that people have really, pulled my teeth to get me there. But, that's it. I've never really had to say anything. There have been a couple times where I've had to go on maybe to sing from the side of the stage if someone was sick or something like that, but I've never had to be fully responsible as an actor or singer.
Well, you must have real sympathy and empathy for what they have to do.
Well, I should probably have more.
Especially in your name, in some ways, as the leader. Wow. Now, what kind of a challenge is it? We were just touched on this, to go back and forth between opera and musical theater. There's such different vibes and genres.
They're very different cultures based on very different traditions, and each has its own set of challenges in conducting, playing, the styles, use of language. I think the biggest challenge is knowledge of the new repertoire, that I feel very comfortable in my knowledge of the operatic repertoire to the extent that I'm responsible to teach it.
Uh-huh.
And also in my opera career, I have a lot of experience with contemporary opera. Music theater repertoire, I feel extremely comfortable with the music theater repertoire prior to 1998, when I graduated from, or should I say, before I discovered opera. And then after that, it's constantly working to know what the newer musicals are, to know what's out each year, what's winning the Tonys, and particularly what the students are interested in.
Uh-huh.
That is really tricky. And I honestly haven't figured out how to really stay on top of the newer repertoire in both on a daily basis with everything else they're responsible for.
Yeah.
But it's like you know, knowing your Bach and your Beethoven and your Brahms and music theater, I feel if you know the early stuff
and you know
where everything comes from,
you can find
ways of intersecting.
You must be able to find ways because it's all drama, it's all music when it comes down to it.
Yeah, I think in many ways. The key is listening. Just listen to as much as I can.
Do you have to watch your mood as a director, as a human being going in there and working with, especially students, worried that you might transmit negativity? Do you have to try to keep it up all the time in order so people won't close their minds off?
Absolutely. I think the important thing with teaching is remembering that students don't have full control over their instruments yet. So if you want something softer, you can't just say softer. You really have to help teach them how to play or sing softer. And that's just a broad example. But with everything, I constantly have to remind myself they're experiencing this for the first time.
Yeah.
I feel most successful when I make it about the music and not so much about the student. And so that the student and I are both working together toward the music.
Mm-hmm. As a musical director in general, not as a teacher, are you able to fire musicians if you have somebody who actually you don't think adds up to the whole and participates in the way you want them to?
To an extent. I mean, one of the interesting things is once you start rehearsing, you have a relationship there that extends beyond what's written on paper.
Mm.
And you have to look at that relationship, that personal relationship, and how it weighs out against this paper relationship. Even professionally, my experience has been that you first work with each other toward the common goal
mm-hmm.
of executing the show or the piece. I've been in situations where I've definitely wanted to fire someone.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in situations where a company came very close. I should mention that it's not, I don't think, at least not in a position that I've been in, just a conductor can fire someone. You know, I'm sure there are conductors who can.
Oh, I'm sure.
But in every situation I've been in, it would be a joint decision with an artistic director, a director, with everybody in the room, and many people outside of the room. So in general, for me, that personal relationship has always been more valuable mm-hmm. and nurturing that and finding opportunities to learn with each other.
Yeah, yeah. You're an advocate for contemporary music, it says. I read somewhere. What does that mean?
Particularly in opera. I've done a lot of it, workshopping new works as a pianist, coach, conductor. I think it's important, particularly for operas, to come out and keep generating those great questions that all theater works ask, and that's for basically for a definition, often by challenging those definitions. More and more I see the lines blurring between opera and musical theater, particularly in contemporary operas.
Mm.
And that's just the nature of history, you know, that styles blend and we get more potpourri. But I think that opera has to continue to create new works. And it's surprising, even since I was a college student, how much new works are valued more and more by opera companies.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Damaris. He's a music director, conductor, and composer, and he teaches at Ithaca College. You know, I was wondering about contemporary music. It still feels like the classics are the ones that are going to last.
Mm-hmm.
So when an independent wants to create a new music piece, do they do it on their own or do they have to be commissioned? I don't even know how these things come to being.
It depends. You know, we just had a great opera conductor, composer, and pop composer, Michael Ching, come to Ithaca College to work with our students on his new one-act opera. And he talked to the composition majors, and one thing he was talking about was he was waiting in my studio and he saw my shelf. And he looked at that shelf and said, you know, there's probably less than 50 opera scores up there. And what does a composer have to do to become one of those scores on that shelf?
Yeah, part of the...
The opera repertoire, much like you see a lot of the earlier 20th century music theater repertoire, does tend to become standardized mm-hmm. as time passes.
Mm-hmm.
New composers have to know why those operas are standards. And what made them great and what made them work and what makes things not work and what makes people want to do them and see them over and over again, just like musicals.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for any young composer who's unknown, you're on your own. And it's, again, those collaborations and working with friends and staying true to your passion and finding your own voice. And then for composers who are well-known, they get commissions, and opera companies will commission someone to write an opera because 10 years ago they had a great Pulitzer Prize-winning symphony or whatever it might be. But for young art upstarts, I think learning as much as they can about the theater and the music making and the pieces that were successful, and then finding their own voice there.
Well, it seems like you have to find a universal theme, and you have to fill it with emotion, or else you have to find a point in history or something like that to make an opera work.
In particular, opera and music theater, these are stories based on conflicts that we all share at some level. Yeah, and I think operas and musicals, they're a symbol of their times in which they're created. So that's why you can identify with stories from hundreds of years ago, even if you're setting it to rock music or country music today.
Yeah.
I think that's ultimately where your audience intersects.
And whenever I go see an opera, and I love Madame Butterfly and all the classics, is I'm looking for the beauty of it, too.
Mm-hmm.
You want to see something beautiful, and you want to feel the emotions as well as visuals.
Yeah, I think in particular finding beauty in the things that when we look at them head on in life aren't so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. How has traditional musical theater changed in this culture of so many entertainment choices, you know? I mean, is it still relevant as it used to be, or are people segueing into wanting to look at their little screens and create their own stuff and not really that interested?
I was thinking, you know, I just sort of reviewed my American music theater history, and I realized, you know, why are people fussing that music theater and television and movie, like Broadway, is all movies? This is what music theater has been for 100 years.
Uh-huh.
And if anything, you know, Glee and Smashed and the shows we see on TV where these music theater songs are becoming pop hits, that's how it was in the 20s and 30s and 40s. You know, that's what we want.
So
it's just that our media has changed. But, you know, you go back to the 20s, 30s, and 40s, Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, they were writing hit tunes. And the hit tunes were part of the musicals, from the musicals, back and forth. There was really a revolving door between all those worlds. And I think it's exciting to be living in a moment where that's happening again after it didn't happen for a number of decades.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you also compose. And it said that you compose art songs. Can you tell us what that means?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm a hobby composer. You know, I wouldn't go so far to say I'm an amateur, but I do it for hobby and do it for fun and do it extremely rarely, given my schedule in other areas. But art songs are, I have a love-hate relationship with art songs because as a theater person, I see them, there's a tendency for them to be very boring and academic.
Ah.
But there are many incredible, beautiful, wonderful art songs and entertaining and silly art songs. But it's a genre invented, well, no, I shouldn't say invented, but of like Schubert, Lieder, and Brahms art songs and French art songs. And it's essentially piano and singer. And there's little variety in there as well, but it can be in any language. But they're basically songs set to poems or songs that exist in and of themselves. They don't need a plot surrounding them. Sometimes
they're
written.
But do they tell stories, or is it just a mood that you're creating?
Yeah, they can tell stories. There's, you know, Schubert, Schumann, some of composers wrote song cycles that might have a dramatic arc or a circle around a certain theme. Composers tend to write in sets. Some composers will write all art songs just based on a certain poet. Generally, it tends to be poetry set to music.
Uh-huh. And what kind of themes have you used in some of your? I mean, I hear that your stuff is performed all over the U.S. in certain places.
By friends, yeah. By friends in high places, it tends to be.
And what are some of your themes?
So I've written two sets to poetry by Edna St. Vincent Millay.
Ah.
I actually have a musical that was workshopped. It was written by a friend from my high school years that I worked with in community theater. Named Dan German. It was based on The Portrait of Dorian Gray. And had a workshop, and then he and I both went very different ways in our careers. So every now and then we call each other up and send each other edits and keep working on it. But it's so far on the back burner.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm always interested in what kind of subjects people tend to write about.
Oh, gosh. You know, in terms of playing art songs in New York City, composers setting art songs to the telephone book. And, the Miranda Warning was one of my favorites.
Really?
By a composer named Ben Yarmolinsky. Yeah. It was beautiful and poignant. You know, at the end, the audience is riveted about how the emotional content of the Miranda Warning.
Yeah. I can understand that in some ways, more than the telephone book.
Yes.
Now, since 2008, you've been the director of opera and musical theater at Ithaca College. Tell us about this experience. Tell us what it's done to you as a musician and in your career.
Oh, I see. You know, I lucky to have come to Ithaca College twice, once as a student and again as a faculty member, and I've learned so much more the second time.
Mm.
It's been incredible to figure out how to codify and verbalize what I do, particularly in musical direction, which isn't really codified and written down anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There are some small handbooks that have started popping up over recent years, and there's lots of stories, biographical stories, about music directors, conductors, and particularly the tyrants. But there's nothing, there's no handbook, there's nothing written down that says, this is how you do it, step one, two, three, four. It's a field where, in particular, there's not really a recipe for it, and I think that's part of the reason. But this experience has been great to really live equally in both worlds, in opera and music theater, on a daily basis. And also to learn how to instill storytelling and acting values in young musicians.
Mm.
My favorite part really has been due to the fact that I do it in Ithaca, where there's not that much opera and music theater, aside from what's happening in the summertime and at the local theaters, but on a very large scale at Ithaca College Theater.
Yeah, yeah.
With two large musicals and an enormous opera each year, how I can pick any opera and it will sell out. And the musicals tend to be the same way up there, though we choose them all together. It's really exciting to be able to do a piece. My third year there, we did Monteverdi's Orfeo, mm-hmm. one of the earliest operas ever, surviving operas ever written. You know, you do that at a normal regional opera house, and there's a lot of risk involved. You have to be sure that you get an audience. You have to get people that know what they're doing. You have to get the specialists, and there's all that pressure to do it at that highly academic expert level.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas at Ithaca, by default, you're all learning. So it's been a great opportunity to learn new things right alongside of my fellow colleagues and the students.
Yeah.
And students who will do anything. They're so hungry to learn.
Wow, that's really encouraging to think that kids are really committed in that way. Because, you know, we see in this culture kids that don't seem to be. You know, they're on their cell phones. they're screwing around in,
yeah.
in town and, you know.
I'm lucky that most of my teaching is junior, senior, and graduate level performers in music theater and opera, and they know what they want to do by the time they're there. They're very hungry to be on stage and to perform and to put their knowledge to use.
Uh-huh. When you're choosing musical productions and operas for this town, are you choosing for the people who will come, or are you choosing more for what kind of an experience you're going to be able to give your students?
More the latter. More for the suitability for the students, but not just the performing students, the designing students, the students on campus who are going to come see it for $2 or $4. I know it's dirt cheap up there.
Yeah, yeah.
And also so that students over their typical four-year period will be exposed to a broad array of repertoire. And that's the part that I think really suits the town the most, too, so that you're not going to always come and see the newest musical on Broadway. You can see something classic. You're not always going to see, very seldom going to see Verdi and Puccini because young singers aren't quite ready to do it.
Yeah.
But over a four-year period, you're going to see a sampling of centuries of repertoire.
Uh-huh. How do you feel as somebody who's very involved in this world, the fact that it isn't accessible money-wise to so many people? Opera used to be the people's art.
Yeah. I might argue that opera has always been trying to be the people's art, but because it started as the aristocrat's art, there's always a stigma that it remains that way. And music theater, to me, is much more truly the people's art because it came from the people's music,
yeah, yeah.
popular music, jazz, slave music. I think that, gosh, it's the constant challenge in opera, and it's all the more reason for new opera and doing old operas in new ways. That's something we do at Mill City Summer Opera, being outdoors, sort of takes that pressure off. The audience can come in with a drink in their hands and enjoy it out under the stars.
Yeah, I think people would like to know that they can do that. People think they have to get dressed up, pay $100 to, you know.
Presenting operas in new venues, in unique venues, is part of a newer trend, so that you don't feel like you have to don the tuxedo and the gown to go see the opera. But the truth is, at the largest and greatest and opera houses with the most expensive tickets, that's not always the case either. Jeans and a sweater are just fine. and if you're willing to pay the ticket price. And then, you know, at the Metropolitan Opera last year, I saw a new opera of Thomas Addis's Tempest, went to the box office 5 minutes before curtain. I said, what do you have? He said, I can put you in row O for $20.
Wow.
And I walked in there with my jeans and my backpack and sat however many rows
behind the conductor. We used to do that in San Francisco. I used to go to the opera when I lived in San Francisco, and we'd go to the cheap seats and bring our flask.
Yeah, exactly.
It was really fun. Now, is it really stressful and a huge challenge to conduct a new work? Or do you feel like you have more freedom because there's not the traditions that you have to fall back on?
It's very stressful because they tend to be very hard.
Oh.
And also there's nothing to, you're really sort of out there on your own with your ideas. You have no excuses to say, well, so-and-so did it this way and so-and-so did it that way and so-and-so wrote about it that it should go like this. but you do have the composer there. And most often the composers are really supportive and really helpful and thankful to conductors and directors for doing their works. One new composer that I had the privilege of working closely with was Mark Adamo. I conducted the 60th performance of his Little Women opera.
Oh, yeah.
And this one happened to be in Israel. And, you know, I was young and sort of conducting this for the first time, and he was so open to however I saw those notes on the page. And I met with him at his apartment before going over there, and he pointed out some of the things that people found challenging in previous times and maybe stated like 12 places in the score that he had opinions about. But there, we realized very quickly that we were exposing a very established Israeli orchestra and young singers and training to a contemporary American opera. And so the privilege of getting to do that really surpassed any sort of criticalness about how it should be.
A sense of freedom, too, then.
Very much, yeah. At a certain point, I think the most successful contemporary opera productions I've seen are when there's enough time in the process allowed to reach that place of freedom. Because opera in particular is a field that's used to churning out productions in 2-3 weeks, maybe a little more if it's a new production. But a new work, a challenging new work, takes more time to explore every aspect and every corner of it and work out the issues. Mm-hmm. So they're most successful when companies devote a few years to workshopping them, to trying things out, to letting the composers have that freedom, and then at least a month of rehearsal so that those premiering it get to experience that freedom at some point.
We're almost out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell us about any performances that we might be able to participate in with you? In charge?
Oh, sure. Let's see. In May 2nd and 1st and 3rd, I'll be conducting Die Fledermaus at Tri-Cities Opera in Binghamton. And if you want to come to Minneapolis in June, the next one I'll be doing is Tosca at Mill City Summer Opera.
Wow, great. And do you have any contact information? Website?
Yes, I have a website, www.briandemaris.com, or you can Google me and find me at Ithaca College.
Well, great. Well, Brian Damaris, thank you so much for joining us. Again, we've been talking to musical director, conductor, and composer Brian Damaris. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.